This is an America Amplified special from the New England News Collaborative. I'm Jane Lindholm, host of VPR's Vermont Edition. As governors around New England closed schools and issued orders for residents to stay home, colleges and universities were also forced to take action. In fact, many already had, sending students home and scrambling to launch online education to finish out the semester. But beyond the immediate challenges, many schools are also facing an uncertain fall semester, uncertain enrollment numbers, and a lot of unknowns about their own financial future. Today on this America Amplified special, we're going to look at what's next for colleges and universities in our region, and for the students, staff, and communities that rely on them. And we want to hear your voice this hour. Students, how are you thinking about what you want or need to get out of a college education? Has it changed since the COVID-19 pandemic began? And are you hearing enough of the right information from your college or university to continue in the fall? Maybe the price you're willing to pay has changed as well, either because of your financial circumstances or because of the kind of instruction you think you'll get. If you work in higher education, what are you seeing in the short and medium term? Join the conversation. You can call us. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also send an email to americaamplified@nepr.net. I'll give you that again, americaamplified@nepr.net. Let's introduce our guests. Danielle Douglas-Gabriel covers the economics of higher education for The Washington Post, and she joins us today from her home in Connecticut. Danielle, it's nice to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Rear Admiral Richard Snyder, who is the outgoing president of Norwich University, a private university and senior military college in Northfield, Vermont. Snyder is also a member of the Vermont Higher Education Council's presidential board and serves as the higher education representative on Vermont Governor Phil Scott's task force to restart the state. Admiral Snyder, nice to talk with you as well.
You too, and hi to all your listeners.
Yes, and hi to all of our listeners. Again, if you would like to give us a call and talk about higher education, our number is 800-639-2211. Danielle, I'd love to get a little bit of the lay of the land from you beyond New England exclusively of what we're seeing in higher education in terms of the uncertainties and instabilities that are emerging because of the COVID-19 crisis. And then we can drill down onto what's happening in New England.
Well, the impact is pretty broad across the sector, and it's your very well-heeled schools as well as some of your smaller schools with smaller endowments. Many schools have already announced faculty cuts, layoffs. Presidents have taken pay cuts. Some schools are actually reducing the contribution to retirement plans. All of this in order to stave off a drop-off in revenue. It's kind of, I look at it in two ways. So there's the immediate need, which is to try to stem the financial tide from having to do housing refunds, from in some cases having to help students get plane tickets to go home, and also having to shut down facilities. Now, there are some schools that run like a town onto itself with their own airport, with facilities for performances. All of that shut down. All of that revenue's dried up. Then there's the longer-term issues. And actually, there may be three buckets, because their long-term may be fall in part, and then beyond that, we really don't know what's going to happen. But enrollment concerns, where a lot of schools are not totally certain what their fall class is going to look like at this stage. A lot of schools have actually extended the amount of time students have to commit. Normally around this time, they would know for the most part who's going to be there in the fall. But because they're not certain about what social distancing plans will come from their states, they're not certain about how families feel comfortable about sending their students away, they're giving them a little bit more flexibility. But that makes it really difficult to plan for your budget. And because you have so many responsibilities to the people who work for your school, there's so much uncertainty at this stage.
Yeah, and Danielle, it's kind of amazing that, you know, it crosses all kinds of borders and definitions of what kind of school a place is and what its endowment looks like, that, you know, lots of schools are struggling, even those that you would think of as the richest schools in the nation.
Sure. I mean, look at Johns Hopkins. I think they've been extremely transparent about the struggles that they're facing and the cuts that they're making in order to stem the worst of this crisis. And this is a school that has, I believe, like a $6 billion endowment, a strong research arm, but they don't know what they're going to do. They're losing money. They're not certain that they will have the research money and as well as having income and revenue from the hospital side is all under pressure at this stage. And, you know, if this is what's happening to a major research one university in this country, you have to imagine that every school of various types is feeling the pressure at this point.
Admiral Schneider, is that what you're seeing in the higher education landscape as you look at it as well?
We certainly are here, and especially in Vermont as well. There's this uncertainty is what's so unsettling. And for your listeners, most of the costs in higher ed are fixed. They're not variable. And so the only place we save money when students don't show up is on food. Now, they can really eat, let me tell you, but it's not enough to close the budget gap. And so most of our expenses are fixed. So whether you're short 100 or 200 students, let's say 10% of your student body, that's a huge financial hit to any college.
Yeah. How's Norwich doing? I know you're set to retire, to leave the school in just a couple of days. But, you know, what can you say about Norwich's finances?
Well, we're in great shape. I've been the president 28 years and I'm going to really miss it and our students. But all of us in higher ed are working very hard to make sure our students know that our plan is to open in the fall. The problem here is it's not just we don't know how the students are feeling about going to college this year, but really, we're not running our own ships right now. The governors in all of our states are the ones that tell us whether we can really be open for business or not. Vermont's the third safest state in the union when it comes to the virus. And so, boy, if we can't be open in the fall, no one's going to be open. So we're working very hard to make sure that we can say we're going to be open for business.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We are hearing a lot of schools maybe not making a promise, but making a educated guess that they'll be open for on-campus learning in the fall. UVM said yes to on-campus instruction, but hasn't released details. That's the University of Vermont. Northeastern in Massachusetts is planning to reopen with on-campus classes and says, you know, they're trying to rethink how classroom space and dorms are used to keep students healthy. Quote, the university is also looking for additional student housing in apartment buildings, hotels, and other institutions in and around Boston to accommodate social distancing requirements. Danielle, I mean, some schools that don't have a high percentage of students who live on campus may actually be in a better position than some of those high residency schools to reopen for on-campus learning in the fall, right?
Certainly. I think you are seeing community colleges starting to make that decision. Some have decided to go straight to remain strictly online for the fall, but others are willing to do a hybrid because of the flexibility that already exists in their schedules and the populations that they serve. Same thing with a lot of commuter colleges that don't have high residential populations or any at all. It's a little bit easier for them to pivot, but again, as you know, as the Admiral said, they're still waiting for decisions to be made by governors. And if anything were to change, if a reopening plan that was initially announced for, say, June decides to go to August or any of those things, can completely upend their plans. And keep in mind that while we're all thinking about the fall, there is a lot of summer classes that is a significant revenue driver for a lot of schools, and they're not certain what that'll mean for them either.
Ben, yeah, go ahead, right. Admiral. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, Danielle is right on that. I think most of us, because we all had a pivot in March when we had to send the students home for their own safety, and the safety of our students and our faculty and staff and even our neighboring communities are our moral commitment and responsibility as college presidents. So we are dealing with things that, to be quite honest, we haven't dealt with before, that kind of weight of that responsibility. I think commuter schools are also going to have a problem. I know UVM is concerned because all the kids come back into their rented apartments in town, like around the 1st of June or so. And can they really control social distancing when they're not even on their campus? I mean, legally, no, they can't. We can use our moral influence about teaching them to be responsible citizens and being adults about this and wearing your mask and staying 6 feet away. from each other, but it's infinitely more harder. I mean, I can quarantine my entire student body at Norwich, and so could Middlebury, for example, or any of the other smaller schools that have primarily residential students. But remember what college is all about. It's all about mixing with other people and having conversations deep into the night and playing sports. I mean, the NCAA is going to tell us how we're going to do this and when we're going to do it. So I'm actually not worried about the sports part right now. That will be dictated by NCAA.
Yeah, I'm not old enough to not remember the college experience. I do remember those late night conversations. We got a note from Ben in New Hampshire who says, I go to school at American University in Washington, D.C. Our institution is not giving us any details as to our future. We don't know if we'll be going back to the city or if we'll be spending $40,000 a year or more on online education. The situation is difficult, but the lack of communication the student body has received is terrible. We can't make any plans for the future, which makes financial planning difficult. Kate in Portland, Maine says, I'm a graduate student in my early 30s, and I'm expecting a baby next month. I have been planning to go back to school part-time in the fall, but with an infant at home, I have reservations about returning to in-person classes. I'm curious to know whether schools that choose to reopen might offer remote learning options for individuals whose households include those with compromised immunity or a lack of childcare, et cetera. That's a really good question and good point, Kate. Let's go to Adam, who's calling in from Northampton, Massachusetts. Adam, what's your perspective?
The area that we live in is colloquially called the Five College area. So we're extremely dependent on higher education, and this is never something that I thought that we would have to face at all. So in addition to the colleges here are now talking about furloughing people. With the fall semester uncertain, if people don't return back, it's going to affect all of our local businesses. My wife works for a smaller college, and I have to say that if they don't have classes in the fall, that it's an existential crisis for that organization. So, you know, the ripple effect is huge. And I think that there's a lot of communities, probably like Middlebury and other places, where it's not just the college, it's the whole community.
Yeah, Adam, thanks for making that point. And Danielle, you know, that is a significant factor for many communities. You know, if you don't get students returning, a lot of a community's income may be down, and that can ripple out, as Adam points out, to a lot of different kinds of people. You know, that can't necessarily factor into the decision that a college is making about the safety of its students if they return, but it's certainly something that a lot of communities in New England, especially where there's such a concentration of colleges and universities, must be thinking about.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you already started to see some schools trying to factor that into their calculation about how to treat the community around them. I think outside of New England, but Princeton University was offering grants to some of the coffee shops nearby and all of some of the businesses that rely on their students in order to keep their doors open. I don't know if we'll see more of the same come this fall as schools start to really grapple with the full weight of the financial crisis that they may face, but that has to be a part of the calculation. However, public health concerns may trump that. So,
yeah, it remains to be seen. This hour, we're looking at challenges for higher education in the coming months, maybe even the coming years. Let us know how this is affecting you financially, professionally, maybe in terms of your expectations of what a college experience was going to be like. Has that changed for you? Call 800-639-2211 to join the conversation. Or send us an email at americaamplified@nepr.net. This is an America Amplified special. This is an America Amplified special from the New England News Collaborative. I'm Jane Lindholm, host of VPR's Vermont Edition. We're taking calls from around New England this hour about what's happening right now with higher education and the ripple effects of the COVID-19 pandemic and economic downturn. We're talking with Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, who covers the economics of higher education for The Washington Post, and Rear Admiral Richard Schneider, outgoing president of Norwich University, a private military school in Vermont. He's also an advisor on higher education issues. And we're hearing from many of you around our region as well. Give us a call to tell us what you're seeing in the higher education landscape and how your thoughts may be changing because of COVID-19. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also send an email to americaamplified@npr.net. Maybe you're an adjunct professor. Are you already seeing that your hours have been cut? Are you anticipating continuing with online education? Or to our listener, Kate, who's calling in from Portland, Maine's point, could you see a bifurcated teaching schedule where you're doing some in person and some online for the same class? Again, send an email to americaamplified@npr.net. And let's go to Tom, who's calling in from Manchester, Connecticut. Hi, Tom. What are you thinking?
Hello. Yes, I'm of African-American descent and former graduate of University of Connecticut as well as Manchester Community College. And I'm bringing a different point of view about the gap year or remediation, because if a student isn't ready to be acculturated in college, you don't want them to flunk out or get on, you know, probation. And even if a person of color, you want to be qualified to be there, because I know we can only use race as one, you know, factor and, you know, to succeed. But maybe looking at manufacturing and other type of professions, too, is not all academic, because I know I live in the Manchester Community College, and I know they've talked about manufacturing program, there's IT, information technology, and even we have OASIS as a center for veterans, too, because I know we have ROTC programs at my former University of Connecticut at Stores. So I was saying, you know, one size and fit all. And I guess second, mental health of students, too, and what you go where you can afford, because it's another thing. You're not going to prestigious school that you're going to get in debt for, you know, many years to pay back on a loan. So, and, you know, hopefully parental concern, too, that you can talk it over with your parents what they can afford, and with, you know, good, you know, positive, you know, peer pressure, getting along with your professors, and I guess last, doing your own work and not doing patent cuss.
Yeah, Tom, I hear everything you're saying, and I would love to get Admiral Schneider's take on this, because, you know, Tom is pointing out that there are a lot of considerations that might go into what a student decides to do for the fall, including, are they going to be able to do their best work if there's an uncertain situation, or if they're on campus and then they're sent home, or maybe they don't have a stable home life that makes it conducive to online learning if that's what their school decides to do. So maybe a gap year, maybe some other kind of training. And, you know, certainly the stress and anxiety and other mental health issues that might go into any decision a student makes are going to be paramount for that student and for the family. How are you advising Norwich University students on that question of maybe take a year off?
Well, the nice thing about higher ed, of course, is every student is different, right? And some are really, really ready, and some probably really need to have a gap year or additional prep. So most of our colleges have things like academic achievement centers. I know we do at Norwich, to really help the students even outside the classroom. And most of our smaller schools in particular that don't really hire teaching assistants or don't have graduate assistants, their terminally degreed faculty members really put their heart and soul into educating those students. But it has to be a wide-eyed, open investment that students are making. So knowing what kind of support services are available, your caller is absolutely right. We're all very, very concerned about the mental health of our students. And by the way, the concern over the virus is not just held by students, but it's held by faculty and staff. Some who, when they go home, might be going home to a loved one who is immune suppressed, for example. So how we distance in classroom, we know that for most students, 18, they probably do better in a real face-to-face class environment, which we've been doing for probably hundreds of years, certainly in America, hundreds of years, not thousands, but hundreds of years. The ones online, the good students, and I'm talking about really good students here, can do very well online and do very well online. The studies show the other ones that are not self-disciplined. Your caller is absolutely right. They need the mentoring. They need the advising. They need the wrapping your arms around them or kicking in the butt when they're not doing their homework and saying, where is your homework? Because if you're not doing your homework, you're not going to be successful. So every student is different, but we're advising them to have alternative plans. If they're that kind of a learner, have your plan B. Students, come on, this is life now. This is really important. But we plan to be open, and I know, I think our governor's working really hard with that. And so if we can't do it here, we can't do it anywhere. But I will say one thing about colleges. All of us, if we're going to survive this, and by the way, your previous caller was right. When a school closes in any town, we lost three in Vermont last year, as you know, Jane, the whole town suffers. I mean, grocery stores closed. in those towns where we lost those three schools. And it's a whole community event. But if you're not relevant, that is, the courses that you're offering and the degrees you're giving are not relevant, if they're not flexible and they're not affordable, you will not be in business in 2 or 3 years. It's just that simple. And those are our three guidelines at Norwich to be successful and live another 200 years, because we're the 40th oldest school in America. And our intention is to be open 200 years from now. But there's big changes coming.
Yeah, there certainly are. And let's talk about some of those big changes, because it's not just changes for students, it's or even staff. It's in some cases significant changes, mergers, maybe closures for some schools. And many colleges around New England were struggling even before the COVID-19 crisis. And this economic and structural change of the pandemic has accelerated the closure of some campuses. Let's turn to Thomas O'Reilly, president of Pine Manor College, a private liberal arts school in Brookline, Massachusetts. Pine Manor recently announced that it's going to undergo a merger with Boston College. And Thomas O'Reilly joins us now to talk a little bit about that decision. President Riley, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
So I understand, you know, obviously things were not completely solid financially even before COVID-19 for this acceleration of a merger to happen so quickly. But what was the final straw?
Well, I think that it's not uncommon to hear that small colleges, in particular around the country, are struggling. I think COVID-19 just exacerbated that to and brought it to a point. I think what was special for Pine Manor College is that we were ready to pivot. There were many colleges that I don't think have gone through the thought process to know what they will do if they're hit with a bigger crisis. And I think that that bigger crisis, as the Admiral just talked about, will be showing up in the fall and the spring, where colleges who are not able to open, who lose additional revenues because of room and board and things like that, will be facing serious, serious consideration.
So do you, in some ways, feel like you're in a better situation than some of those schools might be because you're actually doing this somewhat proactively now rather than hoping for the best and waiting till the fall or spring of next year to have to do something like this?
We do feel very fortunate. I mean, we had one objective: best outcomes for our students, for our people, and for our mission. And Boston College enabled that to happen. They were the right partner at the right time. And, you know, what they enabled us to be able to do is commit to a 2-year teach out for our students so that they could continue their education, and if they want, to make transfers. And it allowed us to take care of our people by, in the same way, offering them employment either at Pine Manor College, at Boston College, or if that doesn't make sense, a generous severance package. And lastly, they invested a huge amount of money to support the Pine Manor College student success model, which we're famous for, and putting up $50 million to endow the ongoing expansion acceleration of that. So we do feel as though it was the best set of outcomes we could get, and that it's good outcomes generally.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, you're able to do these things. You were able to work with Boston College. You're not calling it a merger. I'm calling it a merger because it seems to me that that's what it is. But you call it an academic integration. Is that because of, you know, this sort of marketing tactic of not wanting students to depart, or is there a reason?
No, that's a technical. Merger is a technical term, right? It's a legal term about what's happening. Here, what is happening is Boston College will subsidize the operation of Pine Manor College for 2 years. And so that's not the same thing, I guess, from a technical standpoint. From a bigger perspective, however, it's not just one institution gobbling up another and saying, okay, let's roll it right up. It's saying, what do we preserve that's precious about that institution? And that's probably the key to being able to pivot well for any college. And I think the Admiral said it again very well, that one has to be relevant, right? You have to have something that's unique and special, that's really meaningful. You know, in Massachusetts, Pine Manor College is known for number one in diversity, number 11 in the country for social mobility, moving young students that we serve from an economic entry point to an economic success point. That's a big difference. Sterling College in Vermont, you know, there's someone who has cut out a very special mark for themselves about being, you know, ecologically thinking and acting. People who can, Norwich certainly, institutions that can clearly define who they are, prove their relevancy, have a pathway forward. It may be different. We call it Pine Manor College version 2.0, but for each place, there'll be an opportunity if a college can clearly define its relevance, if it can be flexible and affordable the way the Admiral mentioned.
That's Thomas O'Reilly, president of Pine Manor College in Brookline, Massachusetts, now going through academic integration, or, you know, sort of colloquially what we'd think of as a merger, even if it's not technically that, with Boston College. President O'Reilly, good luck and thanks for talking with us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate the opportunity.
This is an America Amplified special from the New England News Collaborative. I'm Jane Lindholm, your host for this hour. And we're hearing from many of you as well with thoughts on higher education. You can call 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or send an email to americaamplified@nepr.net. Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, you cover higher education and the economics of higher education. Do you think what President O'Reilly said is correct about schools that can clearly identify what they are, what they represent, which students might want to go to their school, are going to be in a better position, not regardless of finances, but that those that have a clear identity may be able to withstand this crisis better than others?
It certainly will help having a clear value proposition and articulating that to students and their parents in a way that's transparent means a lot. At the same time, you have to make sure that your books can withstand this, and that's not easy for everybody. Some people have been fiscally conservative leading up to this, not offering steep tuition discounts. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's a sticker price for what a college says that it'll charge you, and then there's the net price of what you actually get charged after scholarships and such are taken into account. Well, we're kind of coming off of several years of schools offering really deep, deep discounts that are hurting them. And some of the schools who engage in that practice in really extreme ways will see that they're teetering on the edge, and this may be the event that pushes them over. So it's a combination of both, having a clear value proposition and then also having a little bit of fiscal sense before all of this happened to withstand this crisis.
Let's talk with another school representative here. Steve Striffler is the director of the Labor Resource Center at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's also the incoming president of the Faculty Staff Union at UMass Boston. The university recently informed some non-tenure track faculty that they won't be reappointed for the fall, although it sounds like that's also still a little bit up in the air. Steve Striffler, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So I understand that about 300 non-tenure track faculty members got letters that said you're not going to be reappointed in the fall. What's the thinking behind that?
I guess it depends on your perspective. I mean, I think from the perspective of the university, it's essentially saying that the university is under no obligation to hire them back in the fall, and I think largely out of fears about about the impending kind of potential fiscal crisis related to, I mean, I think two things: uncertainty about enrollment and uncertainty about state funding kind of for the university, which are two main sources of income. Now, of course, partly because enrollments actually look pretty good, there is a chance, I think a decent chance, that some of them may be hired back, but of course there's no guarantee. I think from the perspective of the people who received the letters, they were experienced, I think, as de facto kind of layoff notices, but also sort of, to an extent, kind of a slap in the face in the sense that these were the same faculty who were asked, with no additional compensation, to carry out the rather large task of moving hundreds of face-to-face classes to online, with very little notice, and kind of to make sure our students reach the finish line this semester. So these pink slips weren't the nicest way to thank kind of the most vulnerable faculty on our campus. So, there's competing perspectives on how to interpret it.
Well, as incoming president of the Faculty Staff Union, what do you think would be maybe a more equitable approach?
I guess for our perspective, it felt premature in the sense that it's sort of anticipating a crisis that we don't know yet exists, in the sense that enrollments look pretty good. We don't know about sort of state funding for the state or state funding. We don't know about kind of federal funding. I think, there are other equitable approaches. You could certainly, I think university administrators are doing this kind of around the country, and often it's symbolic, but I think it makes some financial difference. You could sort of see furloughs or pay cuts from upper administration. You could also look for the money kind of in other places. And these really were, you know, 300 plus of a very dedicated faculty, but also kind of the probably the most vulnerable in some sense, in that they're not paid a lot. You know, they teach a lot of students and work really hard.
Well, I wish the best to all of the faculty and staff members at UMass Boston, tenure track and non-tenure track alike. And I appreciate you giving us a little perspective, Steve. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
That's Steve Striffler, director of the Labor Resource Center at the University of Massachusetts Boston, and he's the incoming president of the school's faculty staff union. We got a statement from UMass Boston, which said, we really support and appreciate these staff members, and also said, quote, as the summer progresses and the university is better able to gauge its academic needs in the face of evolving health and budgetary conditions, we hope to be able to reappoint some of them, but that is not a decision we can make until our financial outlook for FY 2021 becomes clearer. Let's go to Liza, who's calling in from New Canaan, Connecticut. Liza, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on. I'm a very big fan of NPR. I listen to you all day long. I just was offering an alternative experience. I'm an American University parent, and I know there was a student who had written in a comment that he has felt not up to date and in the know about what AU is doing. Our experience has been quite the opposite, and we have a daughter at another college that also has provided weekly updates, and it's been very clear with AU that they are coming out with a decision in mid-June about what they're doing in the fall.
Well, Liza, that's great to hear that, for at least as a parent, you feel like you are getting appropriate information from American University and that you're hearing the right things from them about a decision that will be made in mid-June. It's certainly a difficult thing for so many universities and colleges to try to make a decision, which everybody wants now, before we even know what state guidelines and rules are going to be like. Again, I'm Jane Lindholm. This is an America Amplified special from the New England News Collaborative. When we come back, we'll hear the student perspective on all of this and more faculty members, community members, and others as we look at what's happening with colleges and universities throughout New England. You can join the conversation, 1-800-639-2211, or email americaamplified@npr.net. This is an America Amplified special from the New England News Collaborative. I'm Jane Lindholm from Vermont Public Radio. Today we're looking at the various ways New England's higher education landscape has become even more unsettled in the last couple of months as the fallout from the COVID-19 crisis makes the future of on-campus study, college finances, and student expectations even more unstable. We'd like to hear how this is affecting you or what questions you have about the future of higher education. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or send an email to americaamplified@npr.net. Rear Admiral Richard Schneider, outgoing president of Norwich University, a private military school in Vermont, is with us today, as is Washington Post higher education reporter Danielle Douglas Gabriel. And let's go to some of our listeners. Jessica is calling in from Avon, Connecticut. Hi, Jessica.
Hi there. I just wanted to make what I'm sure my husband tells me all the time is an elitist comment. However, I think we do a disservice to millions of kids in this country. Many of these small colleges that are having financial difficulties are having financial difficulties for a reason. And the biggest reason is that the outcomes once these kids go through these schools are not that great. We need way more technical schools in this country. We need to tell kids it's okay to be a plumber, an electrician. Not everyone should go to college. So if you have a kid who goes to one of these small colleges and you have to really, you know, keep, you know, prodding them on and they're not top students, I think we should get rid of those colleges. There's way too many colleges in this country.
Jessica, do you think that's an elitist position that you're taking? You said your husband thinks that's an elitist position that you're taking. Do you?
No, I do not. On the surface, it seems such. But when you think about all these kids who graduate from these four-year colleges that have no real reputation, that can't get them real jobs. They're competing with kids who go to much, much better colleges. We've done them a disservice. They should be in trade schools and able to be in honorable careers that will make them and their families money. You've got kids who are working at, you know, car washes because they've gone to four-year colleges where they're paying loans and they can't get the jobs.
Well, I have to say, I know some students who have gone to what you might consider elite colleges who still wind up finding themselves in that position. Admiral Schneider, what do you think about that? And you know, regardless of whether students coming out of certain schools have a job or not, should there perhaps be fewer colleges, especially in a highly concentrated area like New England? And should we be maybe focusing more on trade schools?
Well, it's a complicated question. And I would say that generally the industry, I'm going to say higher education in general, expanded greatly after World War II, which is the only other time that our industry has faced such a crisis of not knowing what was going on with enrollment when all the young men went off to fight in World War II. I do think that we're short plumbers and electricians, and there's nothing wrong with being a plumbing or electrician. All the data shows, however, if you get a bachelor's degree, you'll make over the course of your life about $1 million more than you would otherwise.
Regardless of where you go.
Right, right. And I don't think they've been that specific, but there are now studies coming out, and I'm sure Danielle can talk about this with greater expertise than I can. But I mean, there's even studies that show return on investment after 5 years, 10 years, and after a lifetime. And while Norwich is a military college, a senior military college, we have also civilian students on our campus as well. And they actually all do very, very well. But the trick is, and I think to your caller's point, if you are not relevant, those kids are not going to get jobs because the jobs are relevant jobs. So what has to happen is the faculty and the administration has to make sure that the kind of things they're teaching will ensure that students can get a job. And I think that's the most important thing that has to happen.
You know, I heard the president of Colby College on the radio recently saying that Colby in Maine has made a commitment to every senior graduating in this very uncertain spring that they will find those graduating students a job, and not just a job, but a career path job. Danielle, do you think that as colleges and universities move forward, that's going to become more of an imperative? I mean, certainly everybody wants a job when they get out of college, but are schools going to have to prove in some way that they can actually get you that job if you're going to pay for 4 years of tuition?
That's a difficult one for a few reasons. Not every major or line of study is supposed to immediately end in a job. There are some people who want to be academics per se and hope to continue on their education for the sake of enriching themselves and eventually becoming professors and such. And so there's no guarantee of that right away. But I would think, you know, I think oftentimes when people talk about getting a job right out of college, if I looked at the jobs I had right out of college and thought that that was going to be the end-all be-all, then I would have cried when I looked at my degree. You know, where you are your first year out is not where you are 5 years out or 10 years out. And I will also say that there are a lot of community colleges and I think some other small private liberal arts schools that are considering, if they're not already doing, offering trade courses, understanding the community that of where they reside and trying to be responsive to their needs. So I would say that I think that there has to be a diversity within higher education, and that's one of the strengths of the higher education system in this country is its diversity. Are there too many schools? Maybe, but there are also a beautiful, rich wealth of schools and opportunities for students of all kinds. I think making a clear value proposition is important, and then also understanding the complexities and the fullness of what your career will look like coming out of school. I mean, goodness, I was like a drink girl passing out drinks after graduating college, but that wasn't the end of it. And I do, you know, hope that some families will understand that this may just be a temporary blip of where their students are, and it's not the end of it. And also say that student debt does undermine some of the value initially, but it doesn't have to be that ultimately.
We got an email from Lisa who says, as a nurse manager in a small state university for over 2 decades, I'm dismayed that any college is considering how to bring hundreds or thousands of students back to campus this fall. I cannot see that it would be safe to do so until we have a safe and effective vaccine that's been given to most of the population. Ben in Morrisville, Vermont said, a factor that's exacerbating the uncertainty for faculty at colleges across New England is that daycares are now changing their schedule, leaving several families scrambling for childcare. And let's get the perspective of a student here. Jacob Seeker is going into his sophomore year at the University of Southern Maine. He's a commuter student living off campus, and he's a human biology major. Hi, Jacob. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We were just talking about jobs. Do you feel like getting a job as soon as you graduate from college is the most important facet in going to college?
Well, I think it's definitely pretty important just because of how much money most students accumulate over their time in college. But I know for me that I'm going to have to continue to higher education because I want to be a chiropractor. So I definitely have at least a couple more years of schooling after I get my bachelor's.
All right. So you've got a path ahead. You already know which direction you're going. What about for right now? What about for the fall? Has USM told you what the plan is, and are you okay with it?
So far, we haven't heard anything about the plan. I know that summer classes have been transitioned to online for both 7-week terms, and then they still haven't told us about the fall, but I feel like we shouldn't really go back unless we know that we're going to maintain a safe environment. I don't want to go back to college in the fall and then only to have to return in the spring back to quarantine, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you'd rather do online classes for the fall just out of an abundance of caution than have to go back and forth?
Yeah, exactly.
What about the financial situation for you? Are there any issues that you're concerned about?
For me, at least right now, not really, because both my parents have maintained their jobs and I've maintained my job during this, but I know that a lot of my classmates at least have to pay for their own tuition and they've been out of work during this whole quarantine. So I'm definitely concerned for them and how the fall will financially impact them.
Did you say you've been able to maintain the job that you have right now?
Yeah. Yes.
What do you do outside of school?
I'm a barista at Starbucks.
And how has that been for you, working and thinking about your schooling and doing online classes?
Well, so far, luckily, I haven't had to go back to work yet. They've been giving me catastrophe pay. So I haven't had to think about classes as much during it because they shut down our store due to a loss of customers coming in. But I am going back next week, and I'm definitely a little concerned with summer classes and having to work, but so far it looks like my schedule will be manageable.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. And that's a nice benefit for you to be able to get pay while still doing your classes online. Jacob, good luck and good luck to USM in figuring it all out. And thanks for talking with us.
Of course. Thank you so much.
That's Jacob Seeker, who's going into his sophomore year at the University of Southern Maine. And let's go to Chris, who's calling in from Middlebury, Connecticut. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. What's your perspective? Where do you come into this conversation?
Well, a couple of things. I've been trying to make a living as an adjunct, and I foresee, as some of your speakers have mentioned, that most of us are going to be hung out to dry, and we're going to be waiting until the last minute as usual. And there's been no incentive to reduce the supply of you know, people with master's degrees or doctorates, because those justify the senior faculty, the full-time faculty. But I think the internet was the first game changer for this industry, and the second one has been the influence of the coronavirus, which really has kind of doubled down on the influence of the internet, the way that it's changed. I think we can see that a lot of online for-profits have moved into the industry, and they deliver practical education and convenience for the students. And they've addressed global markets already, for example, the military. So that is as kind of signal of where things are probably going to go. I think there's going to be more certification and practical specific skills, the fragmentation of the industry. You don't need a college degree to be successful in certain fields. You do need skills, and your skills have to be updated. So that's where I think things are going to be moving, and the need for a four-year college, I think, is, and the cost of a four-year college, at least on the American model, I think is going to change radically. The good news is that the reach of institutions is going to be much more global now, because you've developed experience and some expertise among faculty to actually teach online. And so you can now, instead of focusing on the New England market or the local market, you can actually attract and deal with students and make partnerships with other schools internationally.
Yeah, Chris, you know, it's interesting. You clearly have been thinking about this, not just from the personal perspective of what this might mean for you trying to make a living as an adjunct professor, but what you might see in the landscape moving forward. I really appreciate your perspective on that. And let's get another one from David, who's calling in from Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, David. What about you? What's your thought?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a graduate student at UMass Amherst, in Amherst, Mass. And I'm really concerned about sort of the overall financial picture for the university, and for myself, obviously. I don't know if I can really afford, let alone, financially, but let alone in terms of my health, to come back in the fall. And it's just really frustrating that, you know, students are constantly asked to pay more and more every year with tuition and fee hikes. Yet the university sort of expands with like administrative bloat and all these positions where, you know, students are really left wondering, you know, how is this actually benefiting me? You know, obviously it's great to have the most widely revered faculty as possible, but it's just really difficult from the student perspective. You know, like how has this gigantic behemoth of like administration and sports and, you know, like assistant coaches and, massive construction and acquisition of satellite campuses, you know, how is that actually going to work now with this crisis where, you know, it's really an uncertain financial picture?
Yeah, David, I want to jump in on you there because you're making such great points. And it actually takes us back to what we started with right at the beginning of this hour. Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, you were talking about schools like UMass Amherst or like other colleges where, you know, it's a whole network. It might be multiple campuses. You said some schools even have an airport attached to them. So, you know, to David's point, what is going to happen? Not that you have a crystal ball, but what do you think?
It's difficult to say because, you know, that some of those larger schools, if they're well positioned financially to weather this, they might be just fine. But so much of that is contingent, if you're a public university, on state support. Appropriations for state schools represent a quarter of their revenue oftentimes. So much of that is also contingent on enrollment. You might start to see schools shrinking some of their operations in order to stay nimble financially. So it really depends on how they are positioned financially, what their value proposition are to their students, and what they're willing to give up in order to remain afloat.
Well, certainly it is an uncertain future for so many institutions, communities, and families as we look at higher education. Danielle Douglas-Gabriel covers the economics of higher education for the Washington Post. We've been talking with her from her home in Connecticut. Danielle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Rear Admiral Richard Schneider is the outgoing president of Norwich University, again, a private university and senior military college in Northfield, Vermont. Schneider is also a member of the Vermont Higher Education Council's presidential board and serves on the Higher Education Task Force with Phil Scott, our governor here in Vermont. Admiral Schneider, thank you so much for your perspective and good luck in your future endeavors.
Thanks very much.
This has been an America Amplified special from the New England News Collaborative, made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Our program was produced by Lydia Brown and Morgan Springer and John Dankosky of New England Public Radio. Vanessa De La Torre is the executive editor of the New England News Collaborative. Special thanks to Jake Rusnak and Matthew Smith. I'm Jane Lindholm from Vermont Public Radio. Thank you for listening.